This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Fayan, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of August 27th, here are some top stories. Arizona and the nation has lost one of its most towering and influential political figures. Senator John McCain died from brain cancer at age 81. KJZZ's Phil Latzman has more on the legacy he leaves.
A war hero, a statesman, an Arizona original, John Sidney McCain was born into a Navy family in 1936, his father and grandfather, four-star admirals. After graduating from the Naval Academy as an aviator, McCain went to Vietnam. In 1967, his plane was shot down in a bombing mission over Hanoi.
I ejected and broke my leg and both arms and went into a lake, parachuted into a lake. And I was picked up by some North Vietnamese.
He then spent the next 5.5 years of his life as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. After being released and retiring from the Navy, McCain was elected as a congressman representing Arizona in 1982. 4 years later, he began what would be the first of 6 terms in the U.S. Senate, earning the nickname Maverick for his independent views and bipartisan legislation. After losing the Republican presidential nomination to George W. Bush in 2000, McCain became the GOP standard-bearer 8 years later, eventually losing in the general election to Barack Obama.
A little while ago, I had the honor of calling Senator Barack Obama to congratulate him. Please. To congratulate him on being elected the next president of the country that we both love.
McCain's later years in the Senate were marked by his strong opposition to President Trump, who as a candidate criticized him for being captured in Vietnam. McCain was harshly critical of Trump's conduct and his campaign's alleged ties to Russia. In an act of symbolic defiance, it was McCain's emphatic thumbs down in the Senate that helped kill an effort by Trump and fellow Republicans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. McCain, who had a history of skin cancer, was diagnosed with a brain tumor in July of 2017. He's survived by his second wife, Cindy, and his 7 children. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Steve Goldstein.
Since Senator John McCain's death on Saturday, there's been more attention paid to how many major issues he led the way on. On Monday's show, 2 that we talked about were immigration and campaign finance reform. Now we turn to former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, currently executive director of the McCain Institute, to talk about the late senator's impact on American foreign policy over his more than 3 decades in office. Ambassador Volker, what were Senator McCain's greatest areas of knowledge and expertise when it came to foreign policy?
Well, there are a couple of key things. One of them was his strong commitment to alliances, to our allies around the world, and to American values of freedom, democracy, human rights, rule of law, security. And so he was both a tremendous advocate for the United States and U.S. values around the world, and a partner for our allies around the world, whether they are governments or whether they're activists and freedom fighters and societies where their rights are repressed. Everyone saw him as someone who was in their corner and fighting for the things that they were fighting for. So it really made quite an impression.
How much of his approach had to do with his general belief in the principles of America, and how much of it was influenced by his military background, of course, that his father and grandfather had great military backgrounds as well?
Well, I don't think you can separate the two, because that is an American value, to believe in the founding principles of our country and to believe that they are worth defending. And that's the reason that his family, his forefathers, went into military service and why he went into military service as well, because of supporting those values. And then when you're in that environment and you travel the world, you meet with other leaders, you see how other people value the United States, it really deepens your appreciation for how meaningful that is for ourselves and for everyone in the world. People, you know, they value the United States, they support the United States, not just because we're a powerful country, but because we stand for the ideals that they want to stand for and they want to see realized in the world.
The balance between diplomacy and military might, there's no question Senator McCain advocated for both. He came under some criticism during the course of the Iraqi surge, his support for being more involved in more places around the world with the military. Where do you think his balance was there in terms of actually wanting military might, but also having great respect for the power of diplomacy?
Well, yeah, obviously he had great respect for the power of diplomacy as well. But diplomacy without force to back it up is empty words. And that's what we saw in the past several years, for instance, with Syria. We had Secretary of State committed to a diplomatic process, John Kerry, committed to diplomacy. But we were not playing an effective role militarily to put our marker on the table to show that we brought something to bear. And as a result, we were completely ineffective in the diplomacy. So he absolutely believes in a strong role for diplomacy, but it has to be backed up by the full force and commitment of the United States, including the potential use of military force.
Is there someone, or is there a feeling in the Republican Party, maybe even the Democratic Party to some extent, that would sort of follow in the footsteps of his combination of military service, service as an elected official, and someone who is very willing and open about his feelings about foreign policy, dealing with other countries, that kind of thing?
First thing that I would say is that there is no one who can really fill John McCain's shoes. He was such a unique individual. His service as a prisoner of war, his time as a prisoner of war, the stature that he had in the U.S. and globally, it's unmatched by anybody. Then you ask the question, okay, so what comes behind? And here I'd again start with Senator McCain. He put a lot of effort into mentoring a new generation of senators that would take up the mantle of responsible leadership on behalf of our national security and American values, and combining the two, values and security. It's not, as John McCain said, our interests are our values and our values are our interests. These are not either or alternatives. And within that, you know, you can rattle off a bunch of names of people that he has been connected to and helped to mentor on both sides of the aisle. One that comes to mind is Dan Sullivan, who's a freshman senator from Alaska, former military service. I served with him in the National Security Council, and he's very committed on foreign policy and very committed on American values. On the other side of the aisle, there's somebody like Chris Murphy, who's a senator from Connecticut and very passionate about foreign policy as well.
I wanted to ask you one final question, and it relates to one of your former positions when you were U.S. ambassador to NATO. The partnerships among the countries with the U.S. taking the lead, how important is it that the U.S. leads, but also leads a truly loyal coalition of other countries that believe in what we believe in terms of foreign policy?
Well, I think it is critically important. We don't want to be alone in the world. It is a difficult, dangerous world, and we don't want to be isolated, or, and even as powerful as we are, we don't want to be acting alone. We want to have friends and allies who share our values, share our beliefs, will assist in the policies, and it really has a tremendous force multiplier effect when we get it right. Senator McCain genuinely believed that, worked very hard at that, and I think we have seen good results when we've done it well.
Kurt Volker is the former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He's currently executive director of the McCain Institute. He's also working as a U.S. special representative for Ukraine. Ambassador Volker, thanks for the time this morning.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Business Desk. Thanks to its strong economy and growing middle class, China is the world's biggest market source for tourism. Last year, the Chinese took more than 140 million overseas trips. By 2030, that number is expected to top 400 million. Public and private groups across the globe are trying to cash in. From KJZZ's Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on Arizona's efforts.
The images are very interesting for the saguaro cactus.
Yeah. Arizona is like a second home to Jonathan Zhang.
I like the nature and the landscape and the western styles of small towns.
He's traveled all over the state and carries that knowledge 7,000 miles east to Shanghai. That's where he lives and works to promote Arizona through the state's Office of Tourism. On a July afternoon, inside a Scottsdale resort, Zhang is attending the governor's annual conference on tourism.
And they spend most per person when they travel.
Consultant Renee Hartman leads a workshop on China. She tells a group of hospitality and tourism representatives that nearly 90% of Chinese travelers are under the age of 40.
Two-thirds belong to the high-income bracket, and they outspend their parents and grandparents by as much as 40%.
Last year, Chinese tourists spent 81,000 nights in Arizona, more than double the overnight stays reported 4 years earlier. Reaching the lucrative market requires different approaches. The Chinese government blocks most social media platforms used in the West, including Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Google. Instead, Hartman says more than a billion Chinese people use an app called WeChat.
So it's not just young people that are on it. It's old, young, rich, poor. Everybody is on WeChat.
The app lets users do almost anything. Text, make calls, schedule doctor's appointments, play games, share photos, pay bills. When it comes to money, Hartman says merchants should think digital. Mobile payment technology is embraced across China.
You know, you might even see a homeless person who has a QR code and is getting payment through mobile payment. So mobile payment is everywhere. People don't even use cash anymore.
Last year, Arizona's Office of Tourism established a presence on Ctrip, a popular Chinese travel site. But Kimberly Todd says building relationships still matters. She takes Chinese journalists and tour representatives on trips around the state and even markets to Chinese students attending Arizona universities.
So we really want to reach out to them and let them know all the great things that not only they can see and do while they're here, but also their friends and relatives who come to visit them.
When they visit, Renee Hartman says hotel and restaurant workers should understand what she calls cultural essentials. She says most Chinese people prefer to shower at night, have a hot breakfast, and warm drinks.
Even when it's hot outside, most people in America in particular love a lot of ice, a lot of cold things. I remember when I used to live in China, I would go and get a bottle of water, and people would love to give me the ones that were iced over because no Chinese person would want to have the iced water. Everybody wants it to be warm.
Educating Chinese tourists is also necessary. Many will travel from Las Vegas to the Grand Canyon and not even realize they're in Arizona. Or they may visit northern Arizona and never venture south. Jonathan Jung says having direct flights from China to Phoenix could make a difference.
I think it's very important to the Chinese travelers because it's time saving. They can spend more time in Phoenix area and southern Arizona. So I think if we have the direct flight, it will be much more helpful.
So why would Arizona, with no direct flights, spend time and resources competing with nearby states that do? The market potential is big, really big. In a country of 1.4 billion people, only 8% have passports. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein with a deeper look at a new teacher study.
The issue of segregation of students has been one discussed for decades in the U.S. education system, even after the Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education lifted it. But research compiled by analysts at the Brookings Institution shows the problem of so-called teacher segregation is expanding. And with me to talk about that is Brookings Senior Fellow Michael Hansen. Michael, first, what made you want to explore this aspect of segregation and diversity more deeply?
I wanted to dig into this issue because we have seen an emerging interest in teacher diversity in this country. As you may know, we have a teacher workforce that is disproportionately white in comparison to the students they teach. So just for the sake of numbers, our students are slightly more than 50% students of color, whereas we have slightly less than 20% teachers of color. And so there's a big mismatch between students and teachers. And so there's a lot of interest that has been growing recently, particularly with new empirical evidence that says that students, really minority students in particular, benefit from having a teacher that looks like them. And one of the things, as we've been conducting this research, that we've found is that teachers of color are disproportionately clustered in areas that are serving these high-need communities. And of course, these, by and large, these are teachers who perhaps came from these communities and are going back to return. But at the same time, we have also observed that diversity is growing across the country. It is becoming much more diffuse, particularly over the last couple of decades. And what we've noticed is that there is sort of a lag effect between how diffuse the student population is and what the teacher population looks like.
Is there an exposure that benefits all students in some sense as well?
There is. Let me first start at talking about the benefits to the students of color. What we have seen recently, I want to say a lot of this evidence has emerged within the past 5 years or so, but we've seen increases in test scores, increases in students' expectations and beliefs about their own abilities in the future, increased high school graduation rates, We see greater likelihood of getting into gifted and talented programs. So there are a number of positive benefits for students of color for having a teacher who looks like them leading the classroom. White students also benefit from having a diverse workforce because they are exposed to teachers as an authority figure. And though we don't necessarily see any changes, we don't really see any changes in their student test scores or disciplinary actions or any of these kinds of things that I've just described. And so we don't see an effect there, but we do see some positive associations with greater tolerance of other groups, differences of opinion, those kinds of social attitudes or multiculturalism that we generally value in our democratic society.
If we're thinking about ways of making the situation better, certainly there has to be an awareness. People have to acknowledge that there is a problem, that there's a challenge. But beyond that, are there certain methods, short-term and long-term, that could help bring about more teacher diversity and at least limit what we're seeing as far as teacher segregation goes?
Well, short-term, this is a numbers problem that is really heavily constrained by the number of college graduates coming from, in particular, Black and Latino populations. If we really want to have a diverse teacher workforce that reflects the diversity of the students, we're going to have to get serious about policies that would improve their college-going success. And so that would be a very critical role to start at. In the short term, we can do a number of things, and some districts have begun to try this. So there are various districts that have begun to try these Grow Your Own programs, where they are intentionally recruiting teacher candidates from their own school districts and from, for example, among the parents of students or recent graduates, or even trying to reach out to kids while they're in high school and trying to get them to think about teaching as a career. One other facet to keep in mind about teachers of color is that they are disproportionately likely to enter the workforce through alternative certification routes. So to the extent that states have lowered some of their barriers to entry, some of the more traditional barriers that actually have, in retrospect, actually blocked many teachers of color from entering the profession, as those have been revisited and lowered in some cases, those states tend to see higher numbers of diverse candidates coming into the classroom.
Michael, let's boil it down a little bit when it comes to our specific state, Arizona. What did you find in terms of teacher diversity here?
Well, let's start with student diversity,
okay.
Or student segregation. Student segregation in the state of Arizona is somewhat near the national average of what we see across the country. So it doesn't particularly stand out there for student segregation. However, teacher segregation is markedly lower in the state of Arizona. I credit this to a couple of things. First, the state of Arizona has just a much more mature, larger population base of Latino adults who have been in Arizona for generations. So they have a much higher level of participation in the teacher workforce, which really helps to improve Arizona's numbers on that regard. So it's been estimated that across the country, some 40% of schools do not have a single minority teacher in those schools. But in Arizona, this number is far, far less. In Arizona, only 2% of schools do not have minority teachers in them. And so in that sense, I think Arizona is doing well and actually is a state that many other states should look to learn from.
Michael Hansen is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
And finally, from the Fronteras desk, here's KJZZ's Kendall Blust in Hermosillo, Mexico.
Mexico's president-elect has proposed creating a special economic zone on the border with the U.S. The governor of Sonora, Mexico, says she supports that plan. Sonora's governor said earlier this week that creating the free zone would bring investment, jobs, and a better quality of life to border communities. The plan includes reducing taxes, raising wages, and matching gas and electric prices with those north of the border. Arizona leaders say they aren't yet sure how the plan would affect their state.
People are very intrigued with what's happening, and there could be the potential for a benefit on the Arizona side, depending on how it really unfolds.
That's Todd Sanders. He's president of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce and a member of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. He says there are still a lot of unanswered questions, but Sonora's governor has a good relationship with Arizona, and her support gives the idea credibility. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.